In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about what the governments of the world are doing to try to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. And our guest for the program is Jim Walsh. He is executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. His research and his writing focuses on a number of issues, including weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. He's written, his writings have appeared in a number of different places, popular press, the Boston Globe, Washington Post, L.A. Times, and others, and also has contributed to scholarly publications, including Political Science Quarterly, the Non-Proliferation Review, International Studies Review. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk and try to cover some of the basics of this issue, the people who are listening are certainly invited to call with questions and comments. The only thing we ask of callers is people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, getting as many different people as possible. However, anybody's welcome into the conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana. In fact, if you would be listening on the Internet, you may also use the toll-free line, as long as you're in the United States. That's 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Walsh, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Good morning, David.
We appreciate you giving us your time. Well, I think to begin, certainly one has to acknowledge the fact that everyone considers this to be a very important issue and something at which we need to at least maintain the level of effort now that we're putting into it, if not step it up. But as a way of putting this into context, I think that you and other people who have talked about this might like to remind us that if you look at the number of nuclear weapons states that exist in the world and look at how things have gone over time, you can go back to a time when people were predicting that today there would be many more nuclear states than there are. So you have to, on the one hand, acknowledge, yes, this is a serious issue. And though on the other, you also have to acknowledge the fact that over time, the number of nuclear weapon states really hasn't grown as dramatically as once we thought that it might.
Well, David, I think that's a singularly important point. A lot of folks that I talk to, they say, "How, Jim, can you work on nuclear weapons? Isn't that depressing? Life going to hell in a handbasket?" And I try to stress to them this historical context. You're absolutely right to say that from 1945 on, everyone predicted that the world would be swimming in nuclear weapon states. In that famous speech by John F. Kennedy, he warned that in 10 years' time, that would have been in the 1970s, counting back from when he gave the speech, that there might be as many as 20 or more nuclear weapon states. And that simply hasn't happened. In fact, I argue that the success we've had in restraining the spread of nuclear weapons is arguably the biggest public policy success in the 20th century. Now, that doesn't mean we don't face challenges today, but back in the 1950s and the 1960s, things looked a lot worse. There were a lot more countries, some 40 different countries, that were interested in acquiring or pursuing a nuclear weapons program, and yet 75% of them decided to give up those ambitions. So I think there's a lot of success here. And as we look forward and try to think about how we might further restrain nuclear proliferation, it's important that we learn the lessons from the past. If we don't keep those lessons and those successes in mind, then we might end up making choices that actually undermine the reasons why we've had the success in the first place.
Well, just for purposes of review, what are the states now that have demonstrated the capacity to produce nuclear weapons?
Well, when you think about the list of nuclear weapon states, you start with the five official nuclear weapon states. Those are the states that, under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, are declared as having weapons and have promised to give them up at some point. And those would include the United States, Russia, France, Great Britain, and China. And to those official five, there are three additional members of the club who are not in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That would be Israel, which acquired its nuclear weapons sometime between 1966 and 1967, India, which tested a nuclear weapon in 1974 and then later in the late 1990s, and Pakistan. And then you have a country that we're not really clear about its status. That's North Korea. They may have a nuclear weapon. They may not. Estimates vary anywhere from 0 up to 6 to 8, but that remains to be proven. And then there are the countries who either built nuclear weapons or inherited them, but then gave them up. And that would include countries like South Africa, which built a small arsenal, but then gave up that arsenal. And then the three states of the former Soviet Union, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine, that all inherited nuclear weapons and could have, in principle, kept them, but decided to give them up.
Mm-hmm. These are all states, and there has been always been concern about states, governments, acquiring nuclear weapons, developing nuclear weapons programs. Now, there also has been a concern, and it seems to be perhaps a little bit more of a concern over the last few years, perhaps since September 11th, that non-state actors, and here I guess we're talking about terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, concerned that groups of individuals like that might acquire nuclear weapons material, expertise, and a completed nuclear device. Is the concern there greater than it has been in the past? And how does one weigh the proliferation concerns if the object is a country, a state government, or a non-state kind of group like Al-Qaeda or something else like it?
Well, those are both good questions. On the first, are people more concerned about terrorist acquisition of a nuclear weapon than prior to 9/11? I would say in the expert community, yes, there's more concern. Now, as it turns out, that is a concern that is probably felt more by American analysts than it is by Russian or analysts from other countries. There is a debate within the expert community about the technical capability of a terrorist group. How hard or easy would it be for a terrorist to build a nuclear weapon? Now, everyone pretty much accepts the fact that a terrorist organization, a non-governmental organization, would not have the technical capacity to build a nuclear weapon from scratch, because that would require that you either enrich uranium or reprocess spent fuel to get plutonium. Those are two materials that you could make a nuclear weapon with. And those processes, enrichment and reprocessing, are technically challenging. They're costly. They're managerially complex. So most folks agree that they wouldn't be able to do it on their own. The question, though, is if a terrorist group were able to steal or otherwise acquire highly enriched uranium or plutonium, would they be able to fashion their own crude device, what's been called an improvised nuclear device? And there the opinion is divided, but there are a lot more people today who think that that's possible than thought that 5 or 10 years ago. So I'd say there is more concern, and particularly in the U.S. Compared to other countries. And as to your second question, how does that change what we do? Luckily, the answer for both the problem of state proliferation, country proliferation, and the problem of terrorist acquisition of nuclear weapons, they both have the same answer. And the answer is relatively straightforward. If you cannot get highly enriched uranium and plutonium, you cannot make a nuclear weapon. So there's a real choke point there. And so the key in both cases is making sure that every gram, every ounce of these materials is under safeguard. Now, that's the good news, that if we want to, this is a problem that we can solve. The bad news is that we're not doing a very good job of it. My shop here at Harvard just recently released a report assessing our efforts in this area. And what we have found is that, at least as it relates to the former Soviet Union, American initiatives to secure the 600 metric tons of nuclear material in the former Soviet Union, we've actually made less progress in the 2 years since 9/11 than in the 2 years prior to 9/11, and that about half that material, that would be 300 metric tons of highly enriched uranium and plutonium, still are insufficiently protected and vulnerable to theft.
Maybe just real quick here, for anybody who might have tuned in the last couple of minutes, I would like to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Dr. Jim Walsh. He is executive director of the Managing the Atom Project, which is located at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And we're talking about nuclear weapons proliferation and the efforts of governments around the world to curb the spread of nuclear material, nuclear technology and expertise. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to call with a question. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just in a moment, I'd like to go back to this issue of securing nuclear material. But first, if we could talk just a little bit more about the goal that no new nuclear weapon states would be added to the list that you made just a moment ago. Is our chief method for trying to contain the number of nuclear weapon states, is that still the non-proliferation treaty, the voluntary agreement that countries enter into where they essentially say they sit down and they sign this piece of paper and says, we are not interested, we have no intention of, we will not develop nuclear weapons?
Well, I think unarguably, that is the most important piece of it. That is the cornerstone of international efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. And again, going back historically, no one would have believed that a government would voluntarily forego the most powerful weapon in human history. I mean, they didn't do it with the bow and arrow, and they didn't do it with a cannon, they didn't do it with a machine gun. But miraculously, governments did agree to do this. And not only did they agree to do it, they set up a mechanism to sort of police the arrangement. And that's what the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, does. And I'm sure your listeners have heard about IAEA's investigations in Iraq prior to the Iraq War, and in North Korea in the mid-1990s, and now in Iran, investigating whether countries are being truthful and living up to their obligations. But there are other instruments as well. There are not only international organizations, but national policies that individual countries adopt. And so that might be export controls to prohibit the export of certain sensitive technologies, or it might be aid and assistance to help countries boost or improve their own internal accounting measures, or it might be treaties to make countries feel safer so that they don't feel that they have to build a nuclear weapon in order to protect themselves, that they can rely on others, the United States or other great powers, to protect them. So there are really a number of different policy instruments that individual countries can use, that even individuals and non-state actors can help with. For example, the international treaty that is intended to prevent states from testing nuclear weapons. And how do we monitor whether countries are exploding nuclear weapons? Well, it turns out that private universities, not unlike the University of Chicago, Champaign-Urbana, out there have seismic facilities for measuring disturbances, and it's this private network of universities and research stations around the world that sort of keeps watch out to see if anyone is violating their testing agreement. So there's all sorts of different things that governments can do, the international community can do in general, and even universities and individuals can do that contribute to nuclear restraint.
We can talk about in some detail all of these things a little bit more. But just to underscore one point that you made, I think there are some people who would certainly be prepared to argue that while it is important, agreements like the Non-Proliferation Treaty are important, and the fact that we secure nuclear materials is important, and that we do everything that we can to make sure that illegal transfers of material or technology don't happen, but that perhaps the in the long run, the most effective thing that we can do, and in fact, it may be more difficult, but as you say, maybe the most effective thing that we can do is to try to set the conditions in place so that countries won't feel that they need to have nuclear weapons. They won't feel that it's necessary to have them in their defense arsenal.
You know, I agree with that, but I also disagree with one version of it. There's and in this way, I'm more of a renegade than some of my colleagues. The conventional wisdom about proliferation is that states decide to pursue nuclear weapons based on two factors: their technical capability and the security threats they face. If they face security threats, then they'll get nuclear weapons. But as I've gone through the nuclear age and studied the individual cases and individual decision making, my own conclusion is that threats are part of it, but not as big a deal as everyone thinks they are, that it's really less an issue of threat. There are countries that pursue nuclear weapons when they're not threatened, and countries that don't pursue nuclear weapons despite the fact that they are threatened. And I really look at it less as a sort of simple formula of capability and threats, and more an issue of the internal politics. You know, in the U.S., for example, we all know that sometimes decisions about national security are not necessarily the reflection of absolute security threats, but of internal jousting between parties or between bureaucracies, or fights between individuals who happen to hold particular positions. Well, the same is true for other countries as well. And so I actually think it's the internal dynamics and the personal agendas of individual leaders or of bureaucracies. You know, does the nuclear bureaucracy need more money, and do they think they're going to get a bigger budget if they have a nuclear weapons program? You know, those sorts of issues are equally important. So in answer to the question, do we want to reduce threats as a motivation for nuclear weapons? The answer is, of course, absolutely yes. But we're still going to be able to make progress even if we aren't able to. You know, we don't have to solve the Palestinian-Israeli issue or solve all the world's great conflicts in order to make progress on nuclear proliferation. And so I think that's actually a positive thing. Part of it is I would agree with, and I'll end here, is I think part of the issue is educating states or educating militaries that their security doesn't have to depend on nuclear weapons. And if anything, by going the nuclear route, they actually undermine their security. They're better off focusing on other ways to provide themselves security, whether that's conventional weapons or alliances or other sorts of instruments. So I think part of it is decoupling or disentangling the notion that somehow nuclear weapons provide you security.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. In Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. During the Cold War, we had a policy of nuclear massive retaliation. And massive retaliation worked on the assumption that any nation which would attack us, we would respond with such a devastating attack, well, it wouldn't be worth their attacking us. We deterred them. It was a deterrence by massive retaliation. Now, when we're threatened by terrorists, we know that there are some small nuclear weapons from the former Soviet arsenal that are missing. I don't think those have, some of them are still missing. And if we should be attacked by terrorists with those weapons, we don't have any specific nation. There's no specific place to which we could retaliate. And even if we could retaliate, it wouldn't matter very much because the terrorists are quite willing to die to kill us. We have suicide bombers blowing themselves up daily. Are you disturbed by any of this?
Well, the caller, I think, makes two good points, which is that deterrence is not likely to work against sub-state actors, terrorist groups. I think he's right about that. And also that a terrorist attack of that kind, there's no return address. There's no place to shoot our missiles at once we've been hit. I think he's absolutely right about that. Now, as to the, and do I think that that's worrisome? Again, my answer would be yes. The only caution I would add, however, is that this issue of, the caller's probably referring to stories suggesting that there are so-called suitcase bombs that are missing from the old Soviet arsenal and that are in the hands of terrorists or other groups. And I think that was a charge made by Alexander Lebed, who has since passed away, and it's a charge that is not held up very well. And it seems that that these missing weapons, quote unquote, really were a function of different counting rules. And, you know, sort of in the U.S., if you ask us how many nuclear weapons do we have, or, you know, how much do we spend on the military, you get, you know, four different answers because people count things differently. It doesn't mean that things are missing. It just means that people are using different systems to answer the question. I think that was the case here. I do not believe, let me put it this way, there is no strong or credible evidence to date that suggests that nuclear weapons have fallen into the hands of non-state actors or to other countries. Now, that doesn't mean it isn't possible. It is possible, but there's no strong evidence that that's actually happened. But the caller is right. It's something that we should be concerned about, and we should be working hard to stop. And what does that require? It requires not only that we secure the material that's used to make these weapons, but we need to be reducing the stockpiles of weapons. And that includes the United States as well. The fewer weapons there are in the world, the better we're going to be able to guard them and ensure that they do not fall into the wrong hands.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that issue, because we referred to it, you referred to it a little bit earlier in our conversation, and also talked about the report that your project was involved in, looking at the amount of potential nuclear weapons material and our progress in securing it, and that you actually found out that if you look at what we've been doing in the 2 years immediately following the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, that in those 2 years, the amount of nuclear weapons material secured was actually less than it had been in the years before September 11th. And you would certainly think that our awareness, our sense of urgency, would be much greater following September 11th. So why is it that we're actually, our progress on this has actually been less since 9/11?
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's actually hard to believe. But we were very careful and cautious as we went through and evaluated American programs on this score. And David, there's one big answer, and then there are lots of small answers. And so the little small answers are things like bureaucratic infighting and lack of an agreement on tax liability. U.S. firms don't want to go in Russia and work on these projects without some sort of agreement in advance that they won't be liable for taxes. And the Russians and the Americans haven't settled up on an agreement, so stuff sits in warehouses uninstalled, and contractors aren't doing the work they're supposed to do. And, you know, and on and on, and a lack of reciprocity. The U.S. is sort of taking the attitude my dad used to take when I was a young teenager, which was, you know, as long as I'm paying the rent and paying for your school, you're going to do what I say, and that's the end of the story. And we're writing the checks here to help pay for this. And so we want the Russians to open up all their facilities, but we don't want to open our facilities up to them. And so there's a lack of reciprocity, and as you might imagine, this ruffles the Russians' feathers somewhat. And so that's in the – when you get to – those are all the little problems, the bureaucratic infighting, lack of reciprocity, lack of tax liability resolution. But the big issue – the big answer to this is it's not been a presidential priority. President Bush has said all the right things. He says that he's concerned about it. He says that it's the number one threat to U.S. national security and that he's worried about it. But this is one of those cases where they're talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. If President Bush put half the effort into this issue, made it half the presidential priority that he had made Iraq, then I think we wouldn't have fallen behind in the 2 years after 9/11. We would have had this done a heck of a lot sooner. But it hasn't been his number one priority. I mean, we have to be honest here. Iraq has been his number one priority, and particularly once American servicemen and women started dying, which is easily understandable. Anytime you have troops dying in the field, that's going to be your number one priority. And as my mom used to say, you can't have two or three number one priorities. So what's happened is the president has made a deliberate choice to focus on other issues, and that's where his attention has gone. And as a result, things have gotten bogged down in the weeds, and we haven't made any progress.
Well, where obviously there's concern here about Russia, because that's, other than the United States, that was the country that had the largest nuclear program and the most nuclear weapons. So that's where there's likely to be the most stuff that you're going to be concerned about. So also concerns have been raised about Pakistan, just because of concerns about the stability of that government and about connections with particularly Islamic groups. Other than those two places, are there major targets of concern for the issue of securing nuclear material?
Yes, there are. There are dozens of countries that have old-time, old-style research reactors. And some of these research reactors use as fuel the highly enriched uranium, the type of the uranium you would use if you wanted to build a nuclear weapon. And so it's just not Russia, and it's just not Pakistan. It's any of these countries that have these research reactors. And we have a program in the U.S. where we're attempting to persuade countries that have these research reactors to switch over the reactor type so that they will use low-enriched uranium, which you cannot use to make a nuclear weapon, instead of the highly enriched uranium. Now, again, we have had progress there, and we have had some progress in the securing the nuclear material in Russia, but the question is rate. Are we, you know, which is, this is a race, and the question is who's faster? Are we faster at securing the material in these research reactors in Russia and elsewhere, or are the terrorists faster at figuring out a way to steal it? And so my complaint isn't that we aren't, my charge or allegation is not that we're doing zero. We are doing more than zero. My concern is that it's going to take us 10 years or more to do that, and we don't have 10 years to get every research reactor safe and secure and to get all the material cleaned up in the former Soviet Union. But finally, let me conclude by saying that it's not just Pakistan, which is arguably the most dangerous country in the world, and it's not just Russia, but it's all the country, you know, it's all the weapon states. They all have nuclear material. The U.S. has nuclear material, and various, you know, and I think it's better secured here than it is in the former Soviet Union, but there have, we are not without problems here in the U.S., and the Government Accounting Office has pointed to security lapses and problems here in the U.S., and my guess is that's true for all the other weapon states as well, you know, be it India, France, Israel, what have you. So I think there's room to be made in all those countries, or progress to be made in all those countries. And then there are countries like Japan, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, is a non-nuclear weapon state, but is swimming in highly enriched uranium and plutonium, which it uses for its civilian reactor program. So actually, it's a global problem. And that's one thing that I think irked the Russians is everyone talked about this as if it was a Russian problem and that somehow the Russians messed up and it's all their fault. The biggest problem by volume is in Russia, but this is really a global problem, and it involves many, many more countries beyond the former Soviet Union.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint. We have some other callers who we'll get right to, but I would like to again introduce the guest for this first hour of Focus. We're speaking with Dr. Jim Walsh. He's Executive Director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And in his research and writing, he's focused on a number of issues, including terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. By the way, if you're interested in finding out more about him or about the Belfer Center and you have internet access, they have a website, or you can go to just go to the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and click on through there, and you can find out about the Belfer Center.
And David, the easiest way to get to the Managing the Atom website, just for your listeners, you can just type the phrase, as long and cumbersome as it is, Managing the Atom, one word, Managing the Atom, .org, and you'll go straight to our website.
Very good. And, of course, questions here are welcome. We have several people ready to go. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line if you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. We have several callers here. They're all in Urbana. We'll just take them in the order they came, starting with line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Let's see. I don't want to make this too politically partisan, so please don't feel like I'm egging you on or anything like that. But and just as in fact, I'd like to just ask my question and listen on the radio, your answer. But what I wanted to ask about was when North Korea and Iraq were both in the news, we had the administration was basically, you know, terrorizing us about all these weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and links with terrorism. And then at the same time, North Korea was collecting up fuel rods, uranium fuel rods, and taking them out of away from view from the inspectors, and we were doing nothing. And we were, you know, with Saddam, we're talking about, you know, you can't talk with the terrorists and you can't negotiate with them, and yet with North Korea, we were allowing them to just scoop up all their fissionable material and just take them from view with the possibility of making with it, which it was a known fact that North Korea had fissionable material and still has, as far as we know, and we were essentially doing nothing about it. And what I guess my basic question is, you know, it kind of seems as though the Bush administration is almost, you know, nurturing this North Korean nuclear program, basically, like, so they have an enemy for their second, you know, for their second term if they can get one or something like that. So again, that's my own suspicion and my own ideas or whatever. But I don't want to egg you on too much. So just feel free to answer however you'd like.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, Dr. Walsh, you take that however you like.
Sure. And let me comment about President Bush's policy on North Korea. First, let me say that it must be that people from Champaign, Urbana are shy, because none of the callers so far have identified themselves.
Oh, we don't ask people to. we believe in anonymity at
okay,
all times.
Well, caller X, who just called about North Korea, let me say this. I don't think this is a situation where President Bush is sort of keeping an adversary in his pocket to pull out later to scare us. I think that's probably not the motivation. But I would agree with the caller that this is he has certainly let this languish. And, in fact, if you remember, just at the end of the Clinton administration, there was great movement afoot on the North Korean issue. And, in fact, Albright, Secretary of State Albright, had visited the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And there was even talk of President Clinton maybe visiting or some sort of big political settlement. But he decided not to go, leave that to the next administration, not tie their hands. Then President Bush was eventually elected after Florida and the Supreme Court. And then the newly minted Secretary of State Powell announced that they were going to continue the Clinton policy on North Korea. Well, the very next day, President Bush came out and publicly undercut his new Secretary of State and said that was not the case, and also ended up embarrassing the visiting President of South Korea by saying the same thing, that they were not going to pursue better relations with North Korea. And the rationale at the time was, we're not going to reward bad behavior. We're not going to reward proliferators by talking and negotiating with them, because that'll just encourage more proliferation. And so essentially what he did was then studiously ignore North Korea for 2 years. And the North Koreans became more and more frustrated and began systematically trying to get the Bush administration's attention by kicking the IAEA inspectors out, by breaking the seals on their reactor and on their fuel rods, by removing the fuel rods, and went through a series of steps. They did everything but test a nuclear weapon in order to try to focus the Bush administration on this problem and to get them back into some sort of negotiation. In the meantime, President Bush called them part of the Axis of Evil and then went and attacked one of the other three members, namely Iraq. And I think at that point, you don't know what's going on in North Korea. It's pretty much a black box. But there's a vigorous debate about, well, once we did that, did they decide that they really wanted a nuclear weapon, that they needed one because they were going to be next on the hit list, or were they still open to a bargain? Because prior to that point, most observers would have said that North Korea was simply bargaining with the only chip they had, which was their nuclear program. But what they really wanted was a normal political relationship, a little aid, and a promise not to attack us. And then, I know this is very long, so let me conclude by saying, then, all this time passes, nothing happens, it gets worse and worse and worse, and then what do we find? We find we're sort of back to where we started, because President Bush has said that they will negotiate, although only in the six-party talks, but they will offer them a non-aggression assurance and that there would be economic benefits, all the things that he said he wouldn't do when his administration started, when we were ready to make progress with Secretary Powell. We're now back to where we were, but unfortunately we've lost 2 years on the bargain.
Well, I don't want to end up spending the rest of our time talking about North Korea, but just to follow up on that for a moment, the Clinton administration obviously recognized there was a significant issue here with the possibility of the North Koreans developing nuclear weapons, wanted to do something about it. So that's how it is we ended up with the famous agreed framework of 1994, in which the United States and North Korea both made certain promises about what they would do. The United States was going to provide various kinds of energy assistance to the North Koreans, and the North Koreans were going to say, okay, on our side, we're not going to develop these weapons. And it looks like neither side kept the promises they made, and each side points to the other and their failure to keep the promises as the reason that the whole process broke down. Is this, in fact, a case where both the United States and North Korea are at fault because they didn't follow through, or is one party more at fault than the other?
David, I think you put your finger on an important point. I think most Americans think that the agreed framework was broken by North Korea. They were the cheaters, and this just proves you can't trust them and they'll take advantage of you. And I think if you actually peel the onion skin back, you see quite a different story. I encourage your listeners to actually go to the web and download a copy of the GREED framework. It is 3 pages long, so this is not heavy lifting, and it's quite simple. And if you read the GREED framework and look at what the U.S. obligations were, you'll be, you know, shocked. We were supposed to normalize relations. We're going to have robust trade between the two countries. You know, none of that happened. And I think if you remember back to the political context, 1994, we get this agreement, and then that is the year in which there was the election that brought Newt Gingrich and a Republican majority to the House and the Senate. And I'm not saying all Republicans oppose the North Korean policy, but the fact was that Congress back then, if Clinton was for it, the Congress opposed it. And so you saw a weakening of support for the engagement policy that President Clinton had just signed off on under the agreed framework. And the North Koreans saw this, and they saw that the agreement was falling behind, and then they began to hedge. They actually maintained their pledge. They pledged not to reprocess the plutonium. And people talk about the agreed framework as a failure. It wasn't a failure. They didn't touch that plutonium, and they froze the program for 8 years or whatever it was. That's in my neck of the woods, that's quite an achievement. Now, they did start to play with Pakistan, our ally, Pakistan, in terms of trying to import centrifuges. Now, they have yet to produce any enriched material, but I think that did violate the spirit of the agreement. So, in sum, yes, both parties, neither party lived up to their pledge. Both parties are rightly suspicious of one another, but the agreement itself did freeze the Korean program for 8 years, and that was quite a success.
All right. Now, other callers here. The next is also Interbanum. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. You can call me caller Q, I guess.
Q.
My question is related to our credibility and our trust throughout the world. It seems like this administration has really set that into question. And referring to the treaties, George W. Bush dismissed, I believe it's the SALT Treaty, saying it was no longer relevant so that we can go ahead and with our interest in research and development of a Star Wars defense system. So my question is, how does that affect our credibility if we're dismissing treaties and saying that, oh, they're not relevant anymore, with other countries in the world signing on to a non-proliferation treaty? What does that mean for them saying, oh, well, this treaty is not relevant anymore for us because we become a greater power and we don't want to abide by this treaty anymore? No. Do you have any comments on that?
As you might imagine, I sure do have a comment on that. I think the caller's right to point to what many countries perceive as hypocrisy. And really, it was the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that the caller was referring to, us wanting to get rid of that with the Russians. But I think the real issue with respect to non-proliferation is the U.S. has, under this administration, decided it wants to research, develop, and even prototype a new generation of nuclear weapons, including bunker busters and small battlefield nuclear weapons. Now, that, to my reading, is wholly inconsistent with Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which requires us legally to bargain in good faith, requires all the nuclear weapon states to bargain in good faith towards the eventual elimination of our nuclear stockpile. And so you can't be fulfilling your own obligations to be getting rid of nuclear weapons if at the same time you're spending money on building new nuclear weapons, a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. And of course, the preemptive doctrine of preemption is one that, coupled with a new emphasis on nuclear weapons, is one that raises issues in the minds of other countries about our real commitments. Now, that doesn't mean that every country is going to quit the NPT because we're not living up to our expectations. But my core conclusion here is you can't stop the spread of nuclear weapons by building more nuclear weapons. We found out in Iraq that we can't do it by ourselves. We need the cooperation of other countries if we're going to get done what we need to get done. And that is true doubly true in the world of nonproliferation. We can't do it by ourselves. We can't force all the other countries to do what we want them to do. We can't police the world and watch everything 24 hours a day, 365 days a week. We need the full and complete contributions of other countries, and we're not going to get that unless we live up to our side of the bargain. We can't demand a bunch of stuff of other folks and then walk away from our own commitments, which is what I think we're doing. So I think that's a fair point. And we see the damage sometimes in that some countries, Iran being one of them, and we can talk about Iran, view the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, as a paid puppet of the United States. Now, I don't think the track record actually proves that. I think the IAEA was actually skeptical about the administration's claims on Iraq and has been sort of a thorn in the side of President Bush. But nevertheless, because of our power and the way we conduct ourselves, we end up undermining the IAEA and the other agencies we depend upon to keep the peace and to police the nuclear world. So I think that hurts us. And so we need to, if we're going to demand things of other countries, we better be willing to live up to our own obligations.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This would be line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, actually, if you wait long enough, your question get asked. You know, I've been waiting a while. Actually, the last question is the one that I was interested in. I guess in addition to that is, you know, what can be done? I guess what's happened here is that we certainly are going in the wrong direction, have been going in the wrong direction. So maybe just a comment or two on that.
Okay, caller 3. Well, I apologize for that. I think part of it is my answers have been long-winded, so that's
why. No. What's happened is that a while back, that's one of the big issues is here, you know, in terms of small nuclear weapons. I mean, this is absolutely crazy, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree, absolutely. And as far as where we go from here, I don't want to be totally damning of the Bush administration. There have been some positive things. The Proliferation Security Initiative, this is sort of the Miami Vice of the nonproliferation world, where you are out on boats and you stop ships that may be carrying nuclear cargo or other banned materials. That has, that was a Bush administration idea, and while I'm not pleased about its present form, it's something that could evolve into a useful nonproliferation instrument. We have a new UN Security Council resolution requiring that countries take steps, pass laws that make it illegal for individuals to be involved in nuclear brokering and black markets and that sort of thing. So I think we've had some progress in Libya, although really something that was spearheaded by the British. Nevertheless, the Americans did participate in that, and despite some real internal divisions within the Bush administration, they did settle up with Libya. I think that's a success. So there have been some successes, but I think we're definitely on a number of fronts moving in the wrong direction. Disregard for our international commitments, a decision to build or pursue, I should say, new nuclear weapon designs, a doctrine of preemption. I think those all undermine our ability. And, of course, the war in Iraq was a war in the name of nonproliferation. And given the lack of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, we've really hurt ourselves. We're certainly at arguably our lowest international standing in decades. I mean, I simply cannot think of another point in my lifetime where the U.S. is worse thought of, not the people of America, but the government, and where our credibility, particularly with respect to intelligence claims, and even more so with respect to weapons of mass destruction claims, is at an all-time low. So there is damage that needs to be repaired, but part of that is just going to be a matter of simple policy. We need to make securing nuclear weapons a higher political priority so that when we go to a summit, that's what we talk about. We're not talking about Iraq. We're talking about securing nuclear material. We've got to end any program that even smells like it's about building new nuclear weapons, and we need to reassure our allies and others that we're committed to this over the long term. So I think there are things that we can do. The battle is not lost here, and as I say, there's a if you step back and look historically, there's a strong record of success and reasons for optimism. But I do think in the near term, we got to fix a few things.
Yeah, the other one is the issue of the environmental impact and the development of these materials. Didn't they? Was it the Department of Defense didn't want to come under the jurisdiction of environmental, the legal part in terms of its cleanup and all that kind of stuff? I don't know. But anyway, a very good conversation.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. one of the things that I wanted to at least touch on gets to one of the big issues when it comes to proliferation, and that is illegal transfers of either material or technology. One of the biggest proliferation stories to break in a long time, in fact, some people think it's the worst example of proliferation ever, was the revelation that the man who is generally called the father of the Pakistan nuclear bomb, Dr. A.Q. Khan, gave nuclear secrets to other countries, including North Korea, Libya, and Iran. So this raises two very difficult questions. One is how well we are doing to try to make sure that kind of thing is not happening. And then what if we find out that someone who is connected to the government of a country that is one of our allies and that we judge is important to us, that we don't want to offend, what if we discover that someone like that, and that was the case here, is involved in proliferation, and, we don't want to anger the government of Pakistan?
Well, David, I think that's a very subtle and a very accurate reading on almost every score. First, the Khan network, I think, is the biggest story in nonproliferation in decades. Some people might say that was the South Asian nuclear test in 1998, but the fact is we knew, everyone in the community knew that India had a nuclear weapon and that Pakistan had a nuclear weapon, so the test didn't materially change what we already knew. This, on the other hand, was a major revelation, and it is still not cleaned up. There's a big meeting in Washington where David Albright, who's heads a non-governmental group in Washington that focuses on nonproliferation, he's a former IAEA or UNSCOM inspector, he says that there are a bunch of the people who were part of the Khan network who have not been wrapped up, who are still in business, presumably still have copies of the designs for centrifuges, copies of actual bomb designs, an old Chinese bomb design that Khan was giving as a freebie. You buy my centrifuges and I will kick in a free bomb design. There are people in that network who are free and who are still maybe plying their trade. So I think it's a huge story. It's hugely troubling. And I'm further troubled by the fact that we seem to have sacrificed that on the altar of bilateral politics. In the Soviet days, we sort of looked the other way on Pakistan's nuclear program because we needed Pakistan's help to fight the Soviets. And in particular, after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, we were using Pakistan as a staging area to run operations and to support fighters in Afghanistan. So we sort of didn't pressure them because we had other fish to fry. And then the Cold War was over. We started to hassle them somewhat about their nuclear program. But then came 9/11, and again, it appears as if we've looked the other way, in this case because we need their help if we're going to find al-Qaeda. Now, Seymour Hersh has written in The New Yorker that the U.S. made an explicit bargain. We'll let Khan alone if you, President Musharraf of Pakistan, are willing to take a Pakistani army into the frontier region, something that hasn't happened in the modern history of Pakistan, or for 100 years for that matter, and go hunt for bin Laden in those tribal areas. You know, Cy Hirsch, when he gets, he's a journalist that sometimes when he gets something, he's the only person to find it out, and he's right. Unfortunately, there's a bunch of things he's often wrong about, too, so it's, you don't know how to take it. But it's clearly the case that we have not put much pressure on Pakistan over the Khan network. The Khan part of that network continues intact. And it's also true that President Musharraf has taken his army, as of today even, into those frontier regions trying to flush out al-Qaeda and, in particular, to capture bin Laden. I think it's fair to say that the current administration values catching bin Laden more than they value getting the Khan network. And, you know, that's something that's going to be debated for years. The intelligence community, including former Director Tenet and the current head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, all say that if we got bin Laden, it really wouldn't matter anyway that much. It would matter, but it wouldn't matter that much that al-Qaeda has morphed into from an organization to a movement in which little groups are acting autonomously. So, you know, that's a trade-off. Different people will call it different ways. I personally think it's more important to strangle that Khan network and to find out what the heck is going on there. But, you know, reasonable people can disagree.
Yeah. We're very short on time. I'd like to try to at least get one more caller in here. Go to Urbana, line number one. But I'll have to ask you to be quick if you can, please.
Well, I'm simply going to thank you because you've already answered all of my questions.
There we go again, answering all the questions. Well, in that case, maybe we'll go to someone here on a cell phone, line number two. Hello.
I got a question on what went wrong in Iraq. I mean, it appears like the inspectors were successful, and after the first Iraqi war, we did remove the nuclear and stockpiles or any weapons of mass destruction, and because I heard a lot were removed. So what's your take on what happened there?
And unfortunately here, Dr. Welsh, I can give you about a minute.
All right, I'll be fast. The caller raises a great question. I think the Iraq WMD story, there are two sides of it, and we've only heard one. The one side is our failure to have properly understood what was happening. But the other side, again, is a success story. It's a story that inspections worked, that Saddam was sufficiently scared or deterred by the prospect of additional inspections that he felt compelled to destroy his stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons and felt like he couldn't make progress on the nuclear front. That is a tribute to the effectiveness and the power of IAEA and the inspections and the nonproliferation regime. Another reason why we should be hopeful and why we should be strengthening that as we move forward, that that's a way towards the future and more success. And if you want to know why we got it wrong, I just recommend, I've been going through the 500 pages myself of the Senate Intelligence Report. It covers each of these areas, and you can download it and read it as a PDF.
All right. Well, with much more to be said, there we'll have to stop. Dr. Welsh, thank you very much for giving us your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
Our guest, Dr. Jim Walsh, is Executive Director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. And as we mentioned a little earlier in the interview, if you have web access to the Internet, you can go to the website of the Belfer Center, find out more about our guest, Jim Walsh, and about their activities. That's the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University, the Kennedy School of Government.